Hello, everyone, and welcome to Between the Pages, a podcast on books and sexuality hosted by yours truly, Caitlin Vacora. Awesome. So super excited to have Melissa Fabello on the show with us today. Melissa Fabello is a wellness educator who utilizes online spaces to teach personal, relational, and political development, especially around sex, relationships, and bodies. She holds a PhD in human sexuality studies, and she is just a wonderful human being in general. I added that to your bio, by the way.
Thank you. I'm actually just going to add it officially. Also, just an amazing human being.
TM.
Yeah, official.
I love it. Super excited to have you on the show. And we always start off with the worst sex advice or sex ed tidbit that you've ever received.
I mean, so many. I feel like just living in the world, especially, you know, the more marginalized you are, I feel like the more information that you get about how sexuality is supposed to show up for you, like the worse that your experience is. I feel like maybe the most impactful maybe was around kind of my quote unquote coming out, which is like such a weird idea because like what counts as coming out? But I guess for me, it was like coming out to my mom around my bisexuality and having her response be the very kind of typical, like that's a phase. And in fact, I think what was really interesting, and I've seen like a TikTok about this recently, was my mom's response was actually along the lines of, everyone feels that way about their girlfriends sometimes.
Wow.
Yeah. Right. And being like, I don't think that's true, but like, what are you telling me? What are you sharing with me right now?
Like, A, that's not true. And B, like, are we just coming out to each other? Like, what is this experience that we're having?
Are we now having this experience together? Yeah, absolutely. It's very, very weird. But I feel like that was probably the most impactful kind of piece of like information or like advice is kind of like, don't worry about this. This isn't real. Like, you don't actually have to face this. It'll go away.
Totally. And I do wonder now that you say that, how much of it is attributed to like internalized homophobia or like from a generational level almost, because I do think that like, while we're able to talk about sexuality in a more open way now, it like caveat like a million asterisks to that, but like you know, but I'm like you know, maybe our parents weren't able to do that, and so like, is that where this like it's a phase like super harmful like narrative came from, or is it just
I think it also like for me was couched in, you know, later as we kind of process this, my mom kind of expressing like, well, I was worried about you and I didn't want you to have to live as like a queer person, you know, kind of thing. It's like, that's actually not protective. Like I understand the intentions that you had or the motivation that you had behind trying to downplay my experience, but it was actually harmful to downplay my experience. It wasn't actually like, you didn't help me. It wasn't protective of you to make me feel like what I was experiencing was fake.
That's such a good point. And I do think that like life is harder for queer people narrative is still super pervasive even now.
But even I don't even know that I agree. Yes, obviously the more oppressed you are, the more difficult life is, right? But that's not because I'm queer. That's because the world is queer antagonistic. Like, and it is actually an example of queer antagonism to show up and tell me that my identity or my experience is not real. Like that you're actually making my life hard as a queer person by doing what you're doing.
100%. Like homophobia is the problem, right? Like it's
right.
Not
me.
Not the identity. Yeah. Well, okay. So now I need to ask the inverse of this question, which I added on recently because I was like, wow, it's really depressing how much freaking bad sex advice, sex ed is out there. But do you have like something that sticks out to you in your mind as like kind of like the best sex ed or the best sex advice that you've received?
I feel like more than like a specific kind of something that I was told at some point was more the development of like feminist identity and development around like liberatory politics and understanding sexuality in ways that were different. Like I remember when I first started kind of getting into feminism, which was in like my early 20s, I remember, just kind of having this moment that was like, oh my gosh, so many of the things that have happened to me that have been like really detrimental to my sexual development weren't my fault. And like that super, it's so simple, but it's not something that we're often given as like a gift. This really simple fact that my oppression is not my fault, my experiences with oppression are not my fault, was huge for me and kind of opening up my ability to like rethink what my sexual experience is and kind of redefine sexuality. I think a lot about how like for women, you know, for people of marginalized genders and other just marginalized identities, our sexuality is so stolen from us. It's like at a very young age, your sexuality is already in the hands of other people. Like I think about how the first time I was catcalled, I was like 10 or 11 years old. So I'm just on the precipice of starting to explore sexuality, and it's already been taken away from me. My autonomy has been taken out of it, and it's for somebody else. It's for other people. And it's just, I think if and when you have the opportunity in life to be like, oh, I can actually redo this. We can start over kind of to the best of our abilities. We can kind of flip this script. I think that can be an immensely powerful, powerful thing. And I think it also explains why a lot of like women in particular feel like they don't really come into their own sexually until much later in life, late 20s, early 30s, like in that time, like the older they get almost, the more we feel like we're expressing our sexuality authentically because there's so much to shed before mm-hmm. we can even connect to desire.
I love that so much. And it reminds me of a metaphor that Emily Nagoski has around like tending your own garden when it comes to sexuality. Mm. Everyone's garden is a little bit different. It's very individualized to the person, but it's also like filled with like your past experiences. It's filled with like society's expectations for you. Mm. And it's up to you to sort of like tend to that garden as you experience things and as you develop your own sexuality and say, okay, like what do I want to allow in this garden? What's here that needs to not be here? And it's really, I love that like metaphor of just like weeding out all of the shit that society just really mm-hmm. piles on that prevents us from being able to like flourish, being able to like grow. And I think that's a really powerful way to think about just like the way that we experience sexuality, because I love that point of like, it's not my fault, right? Like this is not my fault. This is not, and also there's like another way to live, right? Like, and mm-hmm. I think that's super important and can be really empowering for folks.
Yeah. It's like, you can do the work. I mean, it's not fun. But it's like, you know, you have the opportunity to maybe do some work around it and kind of unpack some stuff and heal from a lot. And I think even, you know, given that opportunity is already a special thing, you know, to be able to realize that maybe there's another way to live.
Totally. So I know I gave you like a little bit of intro at the beginning, and I was looking at your website, which is, I just love everything that you put out into the world, first of all. I started as a fan, and we'll talk a little bit more about like how our relationship developed.
Has evolved.
It's evolved. I'm also one of Melissa's coaching clients. I forgot the word for a second. I was mm-hmm. like, what is the thing that you do with me? Which is coaching. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But I was looking at your website, and it says that you do political wellness education, which I love. And I'm wondering, like, what does that mean to you? And how does that like framing of what you do show up in your work?
Right. It's so wild because like, as we've talked about, branding yourself is a lot to do with how do I explain what I do in as few words as possible? Like, how do I make it clear? How do I encapsulate what I do? I have played over the years with the kind of idea of feminism or politicized kind of education and the idea of like health and wellness. And I think that I kind of came to this place like, yeah, political wellness education or like politicized wellness education, because essentially I feel like what I do in the world is do education around various aspects of wellness, but from a highly politicized standpoint of like, if we're going to talk about something like self-care, we have to talk about that from a place that is nuanced and is understanding of the power dynamics that take us away from self-care, that makes self-care more accessible to some people, that impacts what we think of as self-care. I really started out doing a lot of work around like eating disorder recovery, which then kind of broadened itself into more like beauty and bodies, kind of the conversation about beauties and bodies and the social, like the socio-political experience of beauty and bodies, which then kind of was like, well, actually, but I'm also doing sex education, which is also relationships, and it just becomes bigger and bigger. I'm like, what do we call this? It's wellness. But it's not wellness in the kind of like typical way that we imagine wellness resources, because it is highly, you know, political and looking at, yeah, what are the social implications of wellness and who has access to wellness and in what ways?
Well, and so then when you're talking about sort of like your day-to-day, like what you do in the world through that lens of political wellness education, like what does that look like for you?
That's a great question. That is honestly an existential crisis. I feel like, what do I do? I don't know if I was saying this to you recently, but like, I really struggle when I like meet a person who's like, what do you do? I'm like, I don't know. Like, I don't have like an easy way to explain it. But the way that I kind of think about it is using the digital media landscape, whether that's writing articles online or using Instagram or doing consulting or teaching workshops or classes. There's all sorts of ways of using the internet to do that education work. I would say that my day-to-day, most of what I'm giving to the public is Instagram. That's like a lot of what I'm doing, is whether that's sharing posts from other people, adding some ideas on there, throwing some polls up, trying to understand where other people are. Earlier today, I had like a question box up about BDSM and like where people feel stuck in that conversation, who don't quite understand it. And then, you know, I took some time to kind of answer some of those questions. So it's really sort of like building some kind of a community of people and having like a clear sense of who my audience is for the most part, where they're coming from, where they are in their thinking, where they are in their worldviews, and trying to figure out ways to kind of push them to the next level. Because I think that we all have a responsibility to understand that wherever we are politically, there are people who are slightly behind us on the journey, just like there are people way ahead of us on the journey. And so kind of situating ourselves in like, how do I bring people closer to where I am so that I can like continue to push them? And I think I feel, when I think about like my role, when I kind of like conceptualize this idea of like, why am I on earth? Which again is very existential. I feel like there's this thing that comes up for me all the time around like education and like thinking about oppression on more of a micro scale of like, where does oppression live in us? How does that impact our relationships? How does that then go out into our community? Because I think so much education around oppression is so systemic. It's like, so like we're talking about institutions. We're talking about these like really, really big ideas and not thinking about, I'm interacting with people, like as a white person, I'm interacting with people in racist ways every day. What does that mean? What does that do to wellness? What does that do for people's ability to feel well, right? And I think that that's important. What does it do for me to be like, you know, engaging in values that are aligned with white supremacy? What does that mean for me and my ability to be authentic in the world, right? And I think those are the kinds of questions that I want people to be working with.
Totally. And I think like it kind of gets to this like concept in sociology, like around like reification, which is like such a nerdy, like, you know, whatever, like I can't get the academic out of me. Somehow it's like always,
it's stuck.
I wish it wasn't, but you know, that was like immediately when you were describing this idea of like thinking about the way that society is structured and like how oppression shows up in those structures. Often we talk about the structures as if they are like a separate thing themselves and not made up of people. And that's a super important thing to like emphasize, right? Like we are actively upholding white supremacy, right? We're actively upholding oppression of others in the individual things that we do, and also in the ways that we benefit from those structures, like those policies and those practices. And I think often when we're talking about like structural racism, for example, like we can think of it as this like very high level thing that like, yeah, of course that's bad, but like we don't see how we then fit into the equation. And I think that your work totally hits on the nail on the head with that of like, yeah, like let's do that self-reflection, right? Like let's do that community care, that community reflection of like, how can we make this world better?
Like what are we literally doing, right? Rather than being like, what laws can we change? Which is like a great way to do the work. But I think that there's also like, what am I doing every single day in my thoughts, in my actions? Like, what am I doing? And how is that impactful too?
Totally. And I think that that's something that I really appreciate about your work, is that you are often super transparent about that self-reflection process. And you are kind of constantly sharing with your audience, hey, this is what is coming up for me this week. This is what I'm thinking about. How is that coming up for you in your life? And so you kind of encourage that self-reflection from your audience, but you also do a ton of internal work around this too.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's always an interesting thing to, you know, obviously you're on some path where like, I've thought enough about a thing before I'm going to be like, hey, I'm thinking about this thing, right? Because that could get dangerous. But like, yeah, it's like, oh, I struggle with this thing. Like, I feel like a lot of the times when I post posts, like from Instagram, it's like the reason why this resonated with me is because I was like, oh, like that, like, ouch, you know, like I'm called out by this post. And like, that is why it like, it's resonating. And that's the thing to post and get people thinking about. And it's, yeah, it's very interesting. And people will be really honest. I did like a poll the other day, cause there was a, like a tweet that had made into an Instagram post that was something like, you know, I really hope that people who go out of their way to buy cage-free eggs are also abolitionists. And I like put up a poll, and some people were 100% okay, because it was their truth, voting that they buy cage-free eggs, but do not consider themselves abolitionists. And I was like, wow, like that is an interesting, there you are. You know, that's where you are and you're honest about it. That's awesome. So that's then the next step is, okay, how do we get you there then?
I bet for every person that is like very strongly like team cage-free eggs and like team anti-abolitionist or whatever, like I bet there's probably five other people who are like, I actually never made that connection in my head and I don't really know where I stand and I may not now need to think about this more.
Now I have to think about it. Why do I buy cage-free? Yeah, it's an interesting, right? It's just an interesting example.
It's so wild. Like that, I'm like, cage-free eggs is like the hill you're gonna die on here. Like,
yeah, that's the hill you're gonna die on. I don't want chickens to live in cages either, but I'm just saying that like, yeah, the point at which you're like, chickens need to be free. People, I don't know. Like, I don't know. That's just wild to me.
Yeah, I don't know. And I think that like, based on my perception of you, like you're someone who is okay with like being uncomfortable and like sitting in that uncomfortableness and be and saying, oh, actually this isn't aligned with like how I view my values or how I view myself. And now I need to like do some additional reflection on that. And I think that that can be a really powerful thing to model for people and encourage that same kind of like, oh, like, you know, that actually isn't aligned for me. And how do I make it more aligned with how I want to be in the world?
And also, I think being clear that we all are living out of alignment with our values. It is impossible almost to live every single day in alignment with your values. That's not happening, right? So I think being honest about like, you know, this is what I'm working on in therapy. You know, like this is something that I struggle with. This is something that every single day I'm coming up against and facing inside myself. Or, you know, to talk about, yeah, like, oh, I'm behaving in X, Y, or Z way that is not awesome. And you don't even have to be explicit, you know, because you don't owe that to strangers to like tell them about whatever harm you've caused or whatever. But I think that like, to be able to say like, I know that I'm, you know, doing things that are harmful. And like, here are some ways that I'm thinking about it. Here are some ways that I'm avoiding it, because that's also going to play a role in all of our lives, is avoiding the ways in which we are not in alignment, because it's scary to think about. And I think just kind of naming for folks, because I think we can get really stuck online. It's like anything else. People only share so much of themselves, and it's very easy to kind of like put people on a pedestal or kind of like idolize people and be like, oh, that's like a perfect, even I do it. Like I have people that I follow that I'm like, wow, like they are just so ahead of me. They are really doing the work. They probably never hurt anyone. That's absurd. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, of course that's not true. But I think that sometimes it's easy to fall into this place where people will see you as perfect in some way. And I think it's important to like shatter that and to be like, I'm making mistakes all day, you know, and I have lots of stuff to work on. And I have like, you know, stuff to uproot around the way that oppression lives in me. And like, that's where the work is being honest about that.
Totally. And I think that like, I don't want to use cancel culture as an example, because I just fundamentally don't believe in it, just in general. And the way that it is framed is just like super, super problematic. But I do think that there is that fear that exists online where you're like, yeah, I don't want to get canceled. I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to hurt someone unintentionally. I don't know enough about this subject to really talk about it. So I'm just not going to talk about it. And I think that that in itself is connected to that same idea of like, well, there's all these other people who never make mistakes, never cause harm. And the reality is like, you are going to cause harm, especially if you hold multiple privileges. Like that is just how that's the water we were swimming in, right? And like, that's how we were socialized. It's going to happen. But the important part is that you understand that it's going to happen and you react and repair that harm in a way that is going to be uplifting folks, you know. Like I think that's the part that's really hard for people to grasp. It's like, it's not like you're never gonna say the wrong thing. Just when you say the wrong thing, fucking admit it. Like that's
right,
really
right,
hard absolutely. For people.
Yeah, I saw a post recently that was kind of something like, it's not like we're canceling people who are being accountable.
Right.
Like, that's not what's happening. When I see people do something that's harmful, I'm always like, I'm not gonna join this pylon. I'm gonna wait and see how they respond. To me, that is the most important thing, is if you're going to be like, you know what I said was transphobic and I understand that now and I apologize and whatever kind of, you know, accountability you're going to go through, like to me, that is like far more important than trying to pretend that it never happened or doubling down or, you know, one of those kinds of reactions, which is, yeah. And I think people just get so afraid of being like told that they did something wrong, where it's like, you should be moving through the world with the assumption that you were doing things wrong.
Right. It's like, it is a framework that you're, that you should operate in. And like, we also don't have a ton of examples of people who do it like well at all. Mm-hmm. You know, quite often the apologies are performative and just, or just like not enough or like defensive. Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of ways to like do this wrong.
Oh, and I think about that every time like a celebrity apology comes out. Like, I'm like, I get it. The PR person is doing whatever they have to do and they're advising them to do whatever they're advising them to do. But it's like almost every single time, it's like completely unaccountable. It's not, I actually did something wrong. Right. And it's just like amazing. I'm like, I don't understand why we can't just say, you're right, I did something wrong. Thank you for letting me know that.
Yeah. No, it totally is. And it's so like frustrating, especially when the apology like dances around this like really wild, like, oh, well, I'm really sorry that people were hurt by this. And it's like, no, you did the thing. Like, it's not just like people are randomly hurt.
Interpreted this. Right. Exactly. You did something that hurt people. It's really different. Yeah.
God, this could be like its own podcast episode, but
yeah.
Oh, Lord. Anyway, you wrote a book.
Yes, I did.
You did the thing. So I'm wondering, with that lovely transition, can you talk about appetite and kind of what you found in your dissertation research and specifically kind of about how women with anorexia experience sexuality, which was your focus?
Yeah. So I did a PhD in human sexuality studies, and part of, you know, the requirements for receiving a PhD in my program was to write a dissertation. Dissertations are really weird documents because they are very special and they're never going to be seen by anyone except like the five people who have to read it to give you a degree. So it is an enormous amount of time to put into a piece of work that then disappears. While I was doing this work, I was already, you know, in a place where I really felt like and continue to feel like academia is not a useful institution in terms of getting information to the people who need the information. And I always felt like my priority will be to get this information to people on the ground, not to get it in journals. Like that seems so irrelevant to me for, again, three more people to read just seems like not a good use of time. So when I was finished with my dissertation, essentially I took mostly the literature review, which is like, you know, the chapter where you're kind of digging into what is already published on the subject. And I was looking at kind of more broadly sexuality and eating disorders, but I was looking very specifically at whether women with anorexia have what their experiences with skin hunger are, skin hunger being kind of related to sex drive, where your sex drive is like the extent to which you crave sexual interaction, and skin hunger being the extent to which you crave sensual interaction. Because the research very clearly points to women with anorexia tending to be sexually averse or sexually immature, or just disinterested in sex. And I was like, okay, I'm looking at this research as a sexologist and being like, wow, like, what about any other kind of touch? Like, this is so narrow. It was just this very narrow, like, women with anorexia do not want penises inside of them. And I'm like, what is this, like, very cis heteronormative, very narrow understanding of sex, research being done on populations that are primarily white, primarily, you know, middle to upper class, like what is this? This is so useless. So feeling like I wanted to ask this other question about sensuality, but feeling like it felt really important to not prioritize academia in that. So I took, yeah, like the lit review section and then the sections that were about kind of my own personal research that I did, trying to understand how women living with or in recovery from anorexia kind of experienced sensuality. I just turned it into an ebook, right? So I was like, I'm going to just make this less academic in terms of how the phrasing is. I'm going to add some quote unquote editorializing, which you're not allowed to do in academia. You can't comment on anything really. And I published it as an ebook, and it kind of just existed as an ebook for a couple of years. And then Routledge, which is a major academic press, reached out to me about re-releasing it. Republishing it as like a hard, you know, a paperback and making it a hard copy. And I was pumped about it. And so that is how it came to be. And I'm very, very proud to have created something that is more or less accessible. At the point at which it's now published, the price point, I think, is too high. But, you know, it existed for years, you know, as a pay what you can option. Yeah, it's a really, really interesting subject, actually, because we're looking at, yeah, this population that doesn't have a lot of research outside of the eating disorder itself. There's a lot on like anorexia as an eating disorder, and like particularly women, and particularly that, you know, very specific kind of group of women that I was talking about. But to dive into other aspects of their life that is not about food and is not about, you know, their perception of their bodies, and to dig into their relationship to sexuality is like, it's the amount of research on it is very, very little. So yeah, it was a really interesting thing to kind of jump into.
Totally. And I think that like coming into it, understanding the limitations of not even just like the research subject matter, but as you said, like who is being studied, right? Like who are the participants? And if they're typically like white upper class or mid to upper class women, like that is such a small part of the folks who experience anorexia and maybe experience a vast range of feelings within their experience of sexuality. And so I'm curious if sexual identity was sort of looked at in terms of your participants and sort of how that played into the research.
Yeah, sexual identity. So the way that I sort of framed or organized the lit review and then therefore the book was around the circles of sexuality. So the circles of sexuality, right, being these like five kind of domains of thinking about sexuality. And one of those domains is identity. And so identity is gender identity, it's like sexual orientation, it's gender roles, like there's several things that fall into the idea of identity. And so I did look at the research around all of those things. Yeah, it obviously plays a really interesting role, right? There's, you know, when it comes to sexual orientation, there's, you know, this idea, this myth, this kind of prevailing myth that queer women are less kind of exposed to the dangers of an eating disorder because they exist, or we exist in like this countercultural space where we are less concerned with the male gaze. And so there's this kind of myth that exists that's really interesting, because in reality, like you might be queer, but if you're living in the world as a woman, you are still impacted by patriarchy. That doesn't go away. Yeah, some studies, there was like one study in particular that really kind of looked at how people talked about their queer identity in relationship to their eating disorder. And it was very interesting to see people kind of essentially saying that thing. It's like, I'm still a woman in the world. And femmes in particular, people who presented more femininely as queer women, did have some more difficult kind of experiences with body image, but that overall straight women, queer women experience eating disorders at the same rate, although queer women might be more likely to develop bulimia or binge eating disorder. And that was sort of an interesting conversation. But then there's also the conversation about femininity that was also really interesting to look into. And based on the research that I read, it's pretty much the jury's out. There's no clear indication. There's the assumption that higher femininity means higher kind of eating disorder prevalence or likelihood of developing an eating disorder, but that's not inherently true. And that in fact, a lot of the scales that determine or measure are, you know, femininity versus masculinity. Not that I even like that binary in the first place, but that determine that are flawed inherently. And so there's no real way for us to name that is true or not. And then of course, trans women, another interesting, you know, kind of population to look at when it comes to eating disorders, because again, it's a multiply marginalized population. We're not just looking at women, we're looking at women who are also trans, who also have a potential extra hurdle around the idea of quote unquote passing, which is obviously not all trans people's goal, but passing as cis or however you want to think of it, passing is a layer of protection and safety in the world, particularly for trans women, particularly for trans women of color who are murdered at very high rates. And fun fact, trans people are actually the most, in terms of gender, the most at risk for eating disorder development beyond anybody else. And a lot of that has to do with like, yeah, body morphology. And if, you know, it's like almost like a joke sort of in the trans community about like 5 pounds makes a difference, you know, gained or lost makes a difference between how I'm perceived. And so, I mean, and that's valid.
Totally.
You know, and I think that that's also an interesting part of the conversation is like, yeah, we can talk all day about diet culture. But if we're talking about diet culture and not considering the ways in which, yeah, your body morphology impacts your safety in the world, and particularly how you're able to conform to oppressive beauty standards and like the safety involved in that. Like, we're not really talking about diet culture in a nuanced enough way then.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that totally makes sense, especially from a safety perspective. And I'm also curious. So I just finished Aubrey Gordon's book, What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Fat, which is incredible. And so I'm also curious if this showed up in your research when it comes to atypical anorexia, which is like a super shitty, like scientific way of describing folks in fat bodies who are also anorexic. And so I'm wondering if that showed up in your work as well.
So, right. So this is a frustrating thing. For me, when I did my research, I counted atypical anorexia as an anorexia diagnosis. In the DSM, it is not an anorexia diagnosis. It is a OSFED diagnosis, so other specified feeding and eating disorders. I, with my own eating disorder, so previous DSMs listed as EDNOS, eating disorders not otherwise specified, I was diagnosed as EDNOS, despite the fact that I was in a, you know, a thin body because I was not underweight when I was sick.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So essentially you walk in and I mean, really what it reads as is you are not thin enough to be diagnosed as anorexic, even though those are your behaviors. It's like you are you're within a normal, whatever that means, BMI range. And so you are atypical anorexia, and wow, which is wild, right? That is a wild thing that we do. Yeah. So to me, both from my own like personal bias around it, but also just like politically, I believe that atypical anorexia, if you are restricting calories, you are, you know, experiencing anorexic symptomology. Mm-hmm. I don't care what your body looks like. That's irrelevant. It is not safe for you biologically to restrict calories. So for me, when I did my own research, when I was choosing participants, I made atypical anorexia part of the criteria, and annoyingly had to have rationale for it. Like I had to explain why I would do such a thing. Yeah, which is just, yeah, like really shows you the barriers, but unfortunately can't find really any research on it because if people are studying anorexia, they're studying, you know, anorexia nervosa. That's what they're studying. They're not studying atypical. And again, unfortunately, if you're looking at like EDNOS or OSFED diagnoses, they're just lumped together. Like they're all the same. Like all these behaviors are exactly the same. They're just all lumped together. And BED even used to fall under the OSFED diagnosis before it just recently, in the most recent DSM, became its own diagnosis. I mean, they're just like, so it's really, really difficult to find. I did, you know, I definitely made a point to make sure that fat women were a part of the work that I was doing. And their experiences were, you know, as we would expect, is that their, like any multiple marginalization, that their experiences in the world were more difficult. And their relationship to sexuality, therefore, was more difficult. And this idea of, right, when we talk about something like the male gaze, we're also dealing with something like kind of like the thin gaze. There's the white gaze. There's all of these ways in which beauty standards are not just about being thin. That's a huge one. But, you know, that's not all of it. But obviously, that's something that all women, or arguably all people, are working with. But I think that there's a really big difference between being not read as or seen as fat, and then being, you know, being a fat person in the world. And especially the ways in which eating disorder behavior is often encouraged in fat people. You know, they go to the doctor, and if you're losing weight, that's great. Keep it up. And there's restrictions even on fat folks' access to certain, you know, procedures or surgeries based on weight. It's like you have to lose X amount of weight before you can have a certain surgery. Bariatric surgery in itself, obviously, is very controversial, but it is essentially a way to restrict calories. It is a way for you to not get enough nourishment. That is what it does. When we talk about dieting, we are talking about starvation. There is no way to lose weight without restricting calories, which is nourishment. And it's just scary the way that shows up. And one way that it shows up in sexuality is birth control. Like, I don't know if you've like covered this, but like with birth control actually is not effective for people over a certain weight.
That makes my blood boil so much. And yeah, like it is like all of medication really is not geared towards people in larger bodies at all. Like it is, and I think it's like very particularly scary when it comes to the intersection of sexuality when, yeah, you're thinking about birth control, like specifically Plan B is like one that I found out really early just in my personal life. I was like, oh, I'm sorry, above 160 pounds, who is not above that, right? And so like thinking about- like,
that's not a high threshold. When we're talking about weight, that is not a high threshold.
No, and it's not changed drastically since then, right? So like, you know, we're like, there's not even a push from the medical industry to like make that shift.
To change actually, that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, but you're not serving so many people in this moment, and so upsetting. And, you know, I think that like, I'm thinking about Aubrey Gordon's other, like her podcast Maintenance Phase with Michael Hobbs, which I definitely recommend as well. They just covered eating disorders this week. You know, they had someone on who studies eating disorders, and the person lives in a fat body and is like, I was told I'm doing a great job, or like, why am I in eating disorder recovery? Because I am, because like, I need to lose weight. Right. Like, and so just these, and like, she's like, yeah, I'm spitting up blood. Like, this is not okay. Right. Like there's just like a very, there's such clear indications that something is wrong. Right. Like, and people cannot get out of their like fat phobic mindset to like understand that this is a problem. And it's also, side note, this is, it's so wild that anyone with like an irregular BMI or a BMI above the normal is considered atypical anorexic. Like, that is so wild to me. I did not know that before you shared that.
Yeah, it's literally, you have to be underweight. So if you are within, for your height, a certain weight range, like, you know, yeah, my experience was I lost a significant amount of weight in the amount of time that I lost it. And I was as thin as I have ever been, not counting when I was like 12, you know, like, and that was not quote unquote enough, because for my height, that was still in a normal range of weight. And so because it was not underweight, it's not even, it wasn't even overweight, quote unquote, which is, you know, obviously a fake concept, but yet it's literally, even if you fall into whatever they consider normal BMI, you have not lost enough weight for the diagnosis.
Oh my God. Okay. If we keep talking about this, I am going to be really depressed, or more depressed than I already am.
It's wild.
Yeah. And this is making me really excited about your book, because I think that like having that lens as a researcher of like even understanding like that this is like not normal and not okay. Like, I think a lot of academia just has this mindset of like, oh, that's just how it is. Oh, that's just an under-researched population. Am I right? You know, like, and there's just there's no drive to actually change that within academia. Mm-hmm. And so I think making it as accessible as possible and being able to editorialize and be like, hey, this is a huge gap, but like, let's do more research about this is really, really powerful.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, in some ways I was lucky. I mean, academia again is like not a space that I want to give any kind of props to. I was just lucky in the sense that I was not doing like a psychology program. I was able, there was like some wiggle room for me to make decisions about how I wanted to talk about this, because I wasn't trying to do like clinical research, which created at least some like room for me to be like, I'm not going to do it this way. But then to be like, yeah, if I wanted to try to get this published in like the, you know, like an eating disorder journal, would not happen.
Well, okay. So when we're thinking about your work now, so you're still working in the space of, you know, sexuality, body image, wellness, what topics do you see sort of, or subtopics, I guess, do you see coming up in your work?
So many. It's very interesting, right? Because so much of the work that I do, so to give some background, I would say, you know, knowing my audience, you know, particularly like Instagram audience, my audience is mostly people who are thin, white, younger than me, usually by maybe like 10 years, right? So I'm, how old am I? 36. Like, what is time? A lot of the people who follow me are in there maybe like early to mid 20s. Often it's a lot, I know we're going to talk about this, a lot of bisexual women who are in relationships with cisgender straight men, a lot of folks in that category, or people who are questioning. Given that that is a population that is following my work, I feel like a lot of the things that they want to talk about or the things that they're curious about, they're kind of in, and seems like their kind of worldview, the place that they're in their lives, is in a place of wanting to unlearn these things and wanting to, unlearn the ways that they've been socialized, undo a lot of the harm that they themselves are realizing that they've experienced around things like sexuality and relationships, really wanting to unpack why they are in the situation that they're in. So like trying to think through, why do I practice monogamy? Why have I never thought about that? Or asking questions about, around bisexuality. Like, now here I am married to this cis man, and I never gave myself the space to quote unquote explore my queer identity. And now I feel stuck. What do I do? Is something that comes up a lot. It's a lot of white people and white women in particular who are new, or like just kind of like relative babies in the journey of understanding white supremacy, or kind of in that place that we talked about earlier, where they can understand the idea that like white supremacy exists systemically, but have a hard time talking about how it exists within them. It's a lot of conversations sometimes that feel almost frustrating to be having, because I'm not having them in my personal life. I'm not having the same conversations for the most part with the people in my life. And so then coming to people being like, you know, with prison abolition, being like, but what about serial killers? You know, and being like, oh, wow, that's where we are. Okay. It's folks who are, they're on their journeys, and I'm really proud of them. And so we end up talking a lot about, it's almost like I want to call it like on the fence. It's like, I feel like a lot of the things that I want to talk about, they're like on the fence with, they're like, I'm not quite there. And my kind of goal is to push them over the fence.
Totally.
So try to create a safe-ish space, not a coddling space, but a safe space for people to unpack why they're on the fence and to hopefully fall over the fence.
Yeah. And I think that that connects back to what we were talking about earlier of like, yeah, it's starting to question and unpack and understand how oppression lives in you and how you embody like oppressive values, right, in your life. Mm-hmm. And that's like very hard for people to wrap their minds around if they are newer to this work, like it sounds like a lot of your audience is. And one thing that I appreciate that you do on a pretty regular basis is just talking about like, okay, you know, I'm talking about these social justice topics. Think about why you find it palatable for me to talk about it, but you don't find it palatable for a Black woman to talk about it, for example, like, and challenging even just like the way that you perceive information and how that upholds white supremacy as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, absolutely. It's very, yeah, the white supremacy stuff is particularly interesting because it's like, why are you listening to me? You know, and like, and then failing, you know, having the own kind of internal conflict of like, what responsibility do I have? How do I do this in a way that is as safe as possible, right? With like the understanding that like inherently, right, it's upholding white supremacy. That's what's happening. Yeah, it's a very interesting, yeah, there's like the challenge of what makes you comfortable, what makes you uncomfortable and why. And knowing though within that, that I can ask questions that people are going to be mad at me about. And people tell me all the time, like, they're like, you sometimes post things that really piss me off because I have to look at my own self and I don't want to. But like, why did you not dismiss what I said? Because you might dismiss it if, right, like you're saying, if a Black woman said this, you might just dismiss it out of hand. And what's that about? But also feeling like, yeah, well, you need to be asking yourself this question, right? So
it's complicated. It's complicated. And I think like, you know, also following it up with, hey, here's five Black women that are doing this work exactly. that you need to be mm-hmm. following. And you do, I know you've been doing kind of like Follow Fridays lately, which I've been really liking. And, you know, that's important too, right? Is like saying, okay, unpack why you find it more palatable when I say things, but also you need to be like diversifying your feed in the biggest way possible, right? Like you need to mm-hmm. be hearing from these people who are at the forefront of this work.
Yeah, who are actually doing the work, you know?
Right. What,
like, I'm just sharing a post that they wrote. Like, right. I'm not, you know, like, that's all I'm doing. So go totally. Follow them. And
totally.
Leave them alone. That's the other part about it. Is like, follow people, but leave them alone. Don't ask them questions. Don't bother them. Don't ask for education. Don't comment on their stuff. Just leave them alone. Leave them alone. Just give them money and learn things. Like, that's all you need to do.
And, like, just Google. Like, literally just Google. Mm-hmm. It's
so many things are Googleable.
So many.
Try it.
So you talked a little bit about sort of like that, like I'm thinking of like an audience persona, like that profile of like,
yeah, right. Like they're like an avatar. They're a person. Yeah.
I'm like, Jenny is a bisexual woman.
In her twenties. Yeah.
In her twenties, in a relationship with a cis man. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So when we're thinking about like bisexual identity, I'm curious because it's a often requested topic in your work, like what is being bi mean to you right now in this moment in your life? And I guess we'll start there. And then I want to talk a little bit more about like how bisexuality shows up like within the queer community too.
Oh Lord. Oh, one of my favorite topics and most hated topics at the same time is bisexuality. The way that I understand bisexuality, I mean, base level is attraction to multiple genders. It's really that simple. I know that there's some question about bisexual identity versus pansexual identity, stuff like that. But for me, I feel like ultimately bisexual identity is attraction to multiple genders. In my own life, I have, and we can, you know, kind of get to this when we talk about how is bisexuality kind of seen. I have kind of an interesting relationship to bisexuality. And I recently wrote a Patreon post on it because I feel like the most common narrative around bisexuality, particularly for women, is this, you know, Jenny, which is like, I'm bisexual. I've only ever dated or had sex with cis men. I am in a long-term relationship with a cis man. I'm struggling with experiences that I haven't had and even struggling with whether or not my bisexuality is valid if I haven't had these experiences, which is a entire super legitimate mm-hmm. and extremely common and normal experience of bisexuality, right? It's like the way that it's like, that's a perfect example of how compulsory heterosexuality shows up in our lives is that we end up in this situation, right? What I struggle with sometimes is that is not my experience. It's just, it doesn't make my experience better or worse. It is a different experience. My first sexual partner was a woman. You know, my first romantic partner was like that same woman. I have struggled in my life with whether or not I'm a lesbian. I have never questioned whether or not I was straight. Like, that's just not, I never thought that I was straight. I just didn't have that experience. I don't, at this point in my life, I don't say I don't date cis men. I don't, but I mean, I definitely don't endeavor to date cis men. If I met a cis man who was cool, it wouldn't be a no because of that, but he would have to be above and beyond for me to like, be like, this is worthwhile. That's just where I'm at. And like, that is also legitimate. And I often feel like that conversation, you know, isn't being had around how bisexuality doesn't mean that you're necessarily attracted to everyone or wanting to date everyone, you know. And then, yeah, obviously also the, how many people talk about bisexuality or any kind of sexual orientation and don't include trans people is like, also like, there's just so many conversations to be had about bisexuality that's so nuanced. But yeah, I have an interesting at this point kind of relationship to bisexuality, because I feel like in my work life, most of the conversations that I'm having are about an experience that I don't have.
And that's challenging, right? Like that can be invalidating to your own experience, I'm sure. It's hard because I think that experience of being a cis woman in relationship with a cis man, questioning if you're queer enough, that's real. And like you said, that's totally a valid experience. But at the same time, that it can't be the end all be all of the conversation. And so like, it's kind of like questioning where the gaps are, right? Like where, what are we not talking about when we talk about bisexual identity? You know, I have friends who identify as bisexual and are in relationship with folks of the same gender, right? And so like, how does that show up when you're thinking about like this concept of like a gold star lesbian and like other like places where they sometimes they don't feel queer enough because they've been in relationship with folks of different genders, right? And so like, there's like a lot of like stuff to unpack. It's frustrating when it's not addressed, right? It's frustrating when you can't have that conversation in that same way.
Right. And I think, you know, part of the thing that is true is that biphobia is so rampant, and biphobia is showing up in the world at large, and it is also showing up in the queer community. Therefore, I think there's often a knee-jerk reaction that experiences of bisexuality that do not fit a particular narrative are inherently biphobic. Like that's kind of the pushback that I get, is that somehow it is biphobic of me to not want to date cis men. I'm like, I don't have to date anybody. Like, I don't have to date anybody that I don't want to date, right? Like, that is a choice that I get to make. I also am like a big fan of being like, that is also a choice you can make. You know, like, I think again, that is the way the compulsory heterosexuality shows up, is that we feel like if we are bisexual, we have to be open to cis men. Like, we don't. Like, you can say no. And I'm a fan of decentering cis men from your life and like not having them be the center of your world. I'm not really friends with any cis men. Like, those are choices that I have made and that are legitimate choices to make. But I think there can be a knee-jerk reaction around like, because bisexual women in particular are so often left out of spaces and conversations and legitimacy around their identity because they date cis men. I mean, even the fact that literally lesbians will say that they do not date bisexual women is wild. It is wild. And we'll really truly like defend that. Like, we'll really truly believe that that is a totally okay thing to want. And I'm not saying that people can't want what they want. Like, it is what it is. But to not interrogate the way that biphobia is showing up in that kind of assertion is wild. And I think therefore, given the ubiquity of biphobia, I think any conversation about bisexuality that's a little more nuanced, people get very, very, very defensive. And I think that it's coming from a place that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point of like, yeah, like it probably, it is rooted in past experiences of biphobia, right? Like that reaction is coming from there. It's not biphobic to not want to date cis men. It's biphobic to say you're not a real bisexual if you date cis men, right? Like that's the difference.
Exactly. Like your bisexuality is less cool than mine, right? Which is like not like, I mean, I never said that, right?
So yeah.
It's like, in fact, it's wild to me sometimes because I'm like, the amount of time actually that I spend centering cis men in the conversation around bisexuality to benefit other bisexual people, even though in my own life, I'm not really having that conversation at all. I don't know. Sometimes I feel so underappreciated. Like, it's like, I'm doing so much work to make y'all feel better, you know? And then it's, you know, somehow is not okay for me to do what I want to do or whatever. It feels threatening. I think it's because there is an idea of what it means to be queer enough. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I had written about in this Patreon post, was that Demi Lovato recently came out and said that she is too queer to date a cis man. And that like, on the one hand, I was like, yes, like that explains really well what my experience is, that I feel like this huge part of myself doesn't get to be as authentic in the way that I want it to be in relationships with cis men. And I appreciate this kind of this idea. And at the same time, oh, no, that's not a thing. There's no such thing as being too queer enough, more queer because of who you date. Like, that is not reality. And like, can we, and this is a struggle to have with the internet, can we hold multiple truths? Can we do that? And it is very, very difficult to hold nuance and to say multiple things can be true.
Ooh, if we could figure that out on the internet.
Like, honestly, it would save so much grief. I really think it would make a huge difference if we could just get people to be like, you know what, this can be your experience, and that doesn't mean it has to be my experience.
Yeah. And like, in my experience isn't inherently invalidating your experience, right? Like, there's not, they don't exist in opposition to each other. Like, in fact, this is a super vast idea and we can all exist at once, right?
Well, even like, that's what I think bisexuality is such an awesome, I love the bisexual community, because it's like, people experience their attraction so differently. And when you give people an opportunity to talk about how their attraction works, you get 5,000 different stories, because people have really, really different experiences of how their attraction works. And I think we get so stuck on labels and identities, and I'm not anti-label or anti-identity at all, but I think sometimes we can get stuck on, if I call myself this, it means this. We don't allow for there to be layers to what that means. And I think that in reality, what's so awesome about bisexuality is that it encompasses a lot of different experiences. And that's beautiful. That's awesome. And I want us to be able to like uplift that, rather than to be like, you're not bisexual enough if you don't do X, Y, or Z.
Totally. And I think that like, that's one of the benefits of being in the queer community in general that I have so appreciated, is like, we are allowed to like have nuance to our identities in a way that I just don't think is true of straight people. Like, it's, I you know, like, it's just like attraction, identity, even just like gender identity and how that intersects with sexual orientation and how that like, you know, intersects with the way that you like present your gender, and like all these different things look so different and are so nuanced for so many different people. And like, we're able to have that conversation for bisexual folks, but also just like in general in the queer community, in a way that feels really nourishing and feels really like, you know, I struggle with labels as well. Like, I think that there's like so many benefits, and then there's like also so many like things that labels bring up for folks. And so like, I struggle with that, but I also am like, oh, but like, at least we're having that conversation, right? Like, at least we're able to like express, like, this is how gender shows up for me. This is how sexuality shows up for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's important to be able to do.
To have that baseline, even, I think that's what's so awesome about identities, right? Is like, I have a baseline. I always tell people, you know, if you're going to say, for example, I'm bisexual, if someone tells you that they're bisexual, you actually don't know what that means. You don't know what it means to them, right? You don't know what it means to them. And so I think that what is really awesome is, okay, I have a foundation for understanding what you're trying to say. Tell me more. Like, what does that mean to you? And I think that that is that's what makes it so cool, is like, there's a way to start a conversation. Like, language is not that sophisticated. There's no way that a word is ever going to sum an entire experience. It's just not, it's not possible, but it is a starting point, and that's awesome.
Yeah. It's like a framework for which you can continue the conversation, to your point.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah.
Well, okay. So I mentioned that I am one of your consulting clients, and unfortunately we had our last session on.
We had Monday. Our last session. So I'm sad.
Really, I was like, so
here we
sad
are again.
I know.
So we're not done.
I was like, you can't get rid of me that quickly. Thank you. But yeah, no, so I've had that pleasure of being one of your clients, but I'm wondering if you can kind of talk about that side of your work that's like a little less Instagram, a little bit more like digital strategy things.
It's behind the scenes. Yeah, so I do digital content strategy consulting, which sounds really fancy, but is really just working with people around projects, digital projects that they are doing, usually almost always in the realm of wellness in some way. So I do work with people on podcasts, I do work with people on blogs, I help people who want to write online, people who are rebranding websites, folks who want to write an ebook, people who want to provide online services, just lots and lots of different ways that people want to do work online and figure out what is the best way to kind of encapsulate the work that they do. How do you talk about the work that you do? How do you brand it? It's interesting because as much as at the end of the day, what I'm doing is helping people kind of develop their branding, which is like most of what we're, you know, what we end up doing, I think that there's, it honestly feels like therapy. It feels like mostly, almost every single person, 99% of people who reach out to me are basically like, I feel stuck. They're like, I have ideas. I know what I want to do. I know a lot about my stuff. I don't know how to do this thing. And I feel so stuck in my professional life. I just need someone to help me. And so I feel like so many of the conversations I end up having with folks is like, they are about their feelings, are about like, I feel like I'm not good enough for this. I feel like I don't have anything to offer. I feel imposter syndrome. Yeah, just all of these different ways that we end up talking about feelings. I have this one client, she's so sweet. And I feel like so many times as we're getting off the call, she'll be like, good pep talk. Like, I feel like that ends up being like so much of the work, because I think folks, yeah, get really, really caught up in what does it mean to be an expert? What does it mean to have something to say? Like, how can I trust that the work that I want to do and the stuff that the content that I want to put out is even like valid? And so I think that it's a lot of like helping people work through their imposter syndrome. And yeah, also get to work on like cool projects and figure out like, oh, this is how your Instagram can work. These are colors that we can use together. These are, yeah, ways to talk about the work that you do, or fonts that work, or like whatever. But on top of that, it gets to be a lot of like digging into the kind of like psychology of why people feel like they can't be something.
So funny that you framed it like therapy, because that's exactly how I was going to share about my experience with working with you. Totally, like, you are my professional therapist. Like, you are my podcast therapist, right? Like, you are someone who is so good at talking through both like feelings of stuckness and also just like ideas. Like, I feel like often with our sessions, I would come to you and be like, okay, so like, I think maybe this is a thing that I want to do. And this is a thing that like could look like this. And by the end of the session, I'm like, oh, cool. I have a color palette. I have templates, yeah, and ideas in which to like frame the rest of what I'm doing. And so it is that kind of like the tangible, like, okay, yeah, you get templates out of this, but also you get sort of that like, okay, now I know what my next step is.
Yeah. Well, I think, right. Because it's like a lot, like I said, like it's a lot of people that are like, okay, I know my subject matter really well. Like someone who's like a therapist, like they're like, I know how to do therapy. What I don't know is how to start an Instagram. Like, that's what I don't know. And so it's just a lot of the work around, who do you want to be? What is your niche? Who is your audience? Like, who are you talking to? And doing some of that kind of more like solutions oriented, or like kind of problem solving kind of brainstorming. Like you said, like people will just come and be like, I want to do, I don't know, like an Instagram post on my boundaries, but like, where do I even start? And so then it's like my job to be like, well, let's see, there's boundaries around DMs. There's boundaries around what you're going to share. There's boundaries around, so like, what are the ones that you want to talk about? And like, what are your boundaries around that? And so that ends up being kind of therapeutic also to talk through. And there are plenty of times when people just show up and they'll just literally be like, I feel like shit today. I feel like I can't do this. I'm having a terrible time. I feel sad. I feel, and it's like, okay, so let's, I had this one client actually, we just ended too. We had worked together for like a year. And she, I feel like every conversation, you know, we would get on the phone and I would be like, you know, how are you feeling? And she would go, honest. And I'd be like, yeah, honest. And I feel like a lot of times she would be like, I feel bad. I'm in a bad place. And even sometimes we'll show up and they'll be like, you know, I'm going through a breakup. And it's like, we can talk about that for 15 minutes. We can talk about that for the whole hour. You know, like, it doesn't matter to me. Like, what do you need to talk about to be able to get to a place where you feel a breakthrough? Sometimes that's it. Sometimes it's, how is this impacting your work? That's valid. Right. Giving people permission. I feel like it's a lot of being like, you don't have to do this. You don't have to post today. You don't have to, you know, if you're working on an ebook, for example, if you're not in the mood to write, let's talk about marketing. Like, we can do something else. Like, yeah, it's a lot of helping people feel permission to work with however their brain is working.
And like permission to like do the thing and not do the thing, which I think is connected to imposter syndrome, but also just connected to like, you know, anti-capitalist, you know, just like anti-productivity, like all of that is so kind of like woven in throughout like our sessions too, of like, yeah, like you don't have to do it. Like, if you don't want to do this, if this is not like bringing you joy, like don't do it.
You know, I feel like sometimes I'll give people quote unquote, like assignments. I'm like really an educator at heart, but I call them assignments. It's like homework, where if people are, say, working on, they want to do like, yeah, they want to start an Instagram or something, then I'll give them assignment to start thinking about what kinds of images or graphics they want to be posting. So like helping them think through that stuff or whatever it is, marketing stuff, whatever. I give them something to start thinking about so that we can talk about it. And so often I will have someone show up at a call and they'll be like, I didn't do the thing that you sent me. And my response every single time is, great. Like, it does not matter to me. You know, like, obviously we want to like make some movement. I don't want people to feel like they got nothing out of it. But I feel like this, people will show up and be like, oh my God, like they feel embarrassed. They feel like they owe me something. You know, they'll be like, oh my God, I didn't do the thing. And every single time I respond, that's awesome. So what do you want to talk about then? Because like, or let's go through it together right now. Because I really want people to get used to the idea that like, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to do anything. And the only way that you're going to be able to do any kind of project that's sustainable is if you give yourself permission to not do stuff.
I love that so much. Are you accepting coaching clients for the spring or the summer, or the fall? What does your availability look like?
That is a great question. It right now, as far as I know, I have one spot open for the summer. So for July through September, and then I'm very open for October through December. So if people are interested in doing that, sending an inquiry sooner rather than later is always going to be helpful. But yeah, it's fun work. You know, you get to work on lots of different projects, meet lots of different people. It's like never the same thing.
Totally. And yeah, I will, if anyone is interested in like following up and hearing about my experience with Melissa working on Between the Pages, totally happy to chat. So just slide into the DMs. And yeah, no, it was a super worthwhile experience for me for sure.
I'm so glad.
Yeah. Okay. So I know we're wrapping up, but you talked about boundaries and now I have to ask about it.
I love boundaries. I'm bad at them.
Yeah. Okay. But you're very good at talking about boundaries, you know, or being public or being transparent about your process of boundaries. So I'm wondering like what boundaries are like, have you been setting for yourself lately? How are you prioritizing rest with all the work that you're doing?
Let's see. Well, one thing is, I'm very boundaried around what time I'll spend working. Like in terms of how many consulting clients I will take, like my spreadsheet where I keep track of like my calendar of clients, I have, you know, spots 1 through 5, and then spots 6, 7, and 8 are like in orange, and 9 and 10 are in red. It's like it's a reminder for me that I should stop at 6. Like I should stop at 6 spots, but I will go, but it's like after 10, you have to stop. Do not take anybody else.
I love that.
And so I think I'm very boundaried out around, yeah, how many hours that I'll work, which obviously that's like a privilege, like to be able to say that. But I think that's one huge one and that allows for a lot of rest. Over the summer, I'm taking very, very few clients because I am going to be teaching 2 courses, and that allows me to make enough income that there's no reason for me to take more people. And so I'm like, oh my God, this summer I'm going to spend on my roof deck, just like reading books. Like that's what I'm going to do. And that's a way to kind of practice boundaries. You know, if we're going to go with kind of what we opened talking about around being honest about where I'm at in my processes, my relationship boundaries are very porous. Talking a lot about that in therapy and working through like, why am I having trouble holding and setting boundaries in relationships with people that I love, and what's going on there, or even unpacking when I can be super boundaried and have a huge wall up and be my boundaries are super rigid. Why is that? Where is that coming from? How is that a trauma response? What do I actually have to, you know, work out in order to be less boundaried? And also just even, this is going to be so meta, being boundaried with myself around people's reactions to my boundaries. So I have a struggle, my kind of like big internal struggle is that I think I am more oriented actually toward being very boundaried. That's not great. So when I start to be active around kind of allowing my boundaries to be a little bit more porous, I actually just knock down all the boundaries. Like it'll just be like, never mind, I don't have a boundary. And I think what can happen is sometimes people will interpret me as very, very rigidly boundaried. And like, I have to practice for myself being like, it is okay, that boundary, you know, is okay. I am allowed to have that boundary. And this person not liking it doesn't mean that I can't have it. And whatever story they're going to tell about me based on that boundary is theirs. It is not mine to fix. That is hard. That is really, really hard. I practiced it really well a couple of months ago, twice in like a week. I did really, really good at being like, no, I have a boundary and that is my boundary. And you are going to respect that boundary. I have been extremely porous with 2 different people. I was like, I've been extremely porous with you around boundaries. And at this point, I'm done. I am done. And this is my boundary. And yeah, your story about that will be yours. I'm not going to internalize it.
Oh my gosh, this is giving me like hives just hearing this. So it's hard work. Like to your point, it's really, really challenging.
I mean, relationships will end.
Yeah, totally.
And that was one of my experiences, was essentially a friend breakup, because I was like, you cannot do this thing. We cannot be in community. It is unfair to me. It is mean what you're doing. And I'm saying no. Mm-hmm. And then I have to process grief. You know what I mean? And it's like, oh, and you start to wonder like, well, what could I have done? Where could I have compromised? And it's like, when you are being self-sacrificial, that helps nobody. That doesn't help anyone.
Totally. And you know, like, and it's not authentic community if your boundaries are porous in a way that doesn't feel good to you, right? Like that is, and that's the hard part is like, yeah, like it might feel like the easier road at first to like not be able to set that boundary or not be able to stick to that boundary. But like, ultimately, like you are not going to be fulfilled in that relationship because you are not exercising a boundary that you need in order to be in community with someone.
In order to feel safe, right? Because like boundaries are about keeping ourselves safe. And I think that there's a question of, am I actually unsafe? right? And like, or my, is my trauma maybe like interpreting a situation as unsafe and this boundary is too rigid for what reality is? Like, that is a question to like ask. But I think that, yeah, there's also the reality of like, I don't feel safe in community with this person if these boundaries aren't respected. And so long as those boundaries are reasonable, you know, like you have to show up for me emotionally. That's like, that's a reasonable boundary, but it's hard because sometimes people be like, I'm not going to meet that. And it has, you have to get, it's very, very hard to be comfortable being like, okay, then I will let you go.
See, like you said that you are bad at boundaries, but it sounds like you're thinking a lot about boundaries and being super intentional with the ones you're setting. So
I'm great at thinking about stuff. I am not so great at sitting in the emotionality of things that are difficult. I'm one of those intellectualized problems. Like, oh, I can talk about this all day. What am I doing? It's a completely different story.
I feel attacked. This is exactly what my therapist always says to me. She's like, yeah, I know you're really good at talking about, like,
I know you're thinking about it. You can theorize about this thing, but like, what are you doing in your life?
Right. So. Oh, that's the ultimate struggle, but it's a lifelong one. So it's fine. We're moving forward. It's fine. Okay. So to bring it back to books, do you have like a favorite sexuality related read that you'd like to recommend to folks?
Okay. So I thought a lot about this when you said you were going to ask me this, and I came up with two that I think are very worthwhile. One is the book Faking It by Lux Alptrom, which is a book about the lies. I think the subtitle is something like the lies that women tell about sex and like why they tell them, right? So like, I loved this book because it was such a smart way to kind of encapsulate several different things, like kind of pull a bunch of things together. So like one of the obvious examples is faking orgasms, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, yes, this is a problem that is happening that is a result of patriarchy, but why is it happening? So I think about like for myself when I was younger, the first sexual relationship I had with a man, I was like 17 years old, and this partner was very, very insecure about the fact that I wouldn't orgasm. And instead of, and at that time I didn't have the kind of like language to understand, like instead of approaching it from how can you experience pleasure differently, right? Like if you can orgasm yourself or you've orgasmed with other partners, what can we do differently? It was just guilting me for making him feel, I guess, emasculated, right? So what I started doing was faking. Like I was like, I don't know what else to do here. I don't want to get guilted. I don't want to get yelled at. So I'm going to just fake it. And at some point he asked me one time, have you ever faked an orgasm? And I was like, do you want my honest answer? And I told him, I have faked every single one with you. And the question becomes, not are you a bad person or whatever for faking the orgasm, it's why did you feel like that was something you had to do, right? So like that was an example. But like another thing that she covers is I have a boyfriend, right? When you get like hit on by someone that you don't want to be with, and like the fact that you are lying, right? And so it's kind of like this ethical dilemma question almost of like, you can say that women are liars, right? You can say that like women are lying, valid. But the question is, why do we feel like we have to lie? And that is a whole different, right? I'm going to lie and say I have a boyfriend because you respect this, you know, theoretical man more than you respect my no. And so it's safer for me to say I have a boyfriend than it is for me to reject you, just like reject you by virtue of saying I'm not attracted to you. And so it's a really interesting book about, yeah, the lies that we tell, but like what is underneath the lies that we're telling.
Wow. I've never read this book. And now I'm like, I need it immediately. Like, this is so interesting. Yeah,
it's a really, really good book. And the other one that I thought of is a book by Maxine Leeds Craig, which is called Ain't I a Beauty Queen? And the subtitle, whatever, is Black Women, Beauty and the Politics of Race. And I'm very interested in beauty, right? As an aspect of attraction and desirability politics, and like who is allowed to be beautiful is a really interesting question to me. And this is a great book that really unpacks how whiteness has played such a huge role in how we understand beauty. Like when you think about like second wave feminism and this huge kind of pushback against beauty pageants. And that's kind of like what is the kind of core thing that it's exploring historically, although it talks about other things too. This like kind of core idea of Black beauty pageants, which cropped up kind of in, not in defiance of, but in response to beauty pageants that did not allow Black women in. That's a really different thing that we're talking about. We are talking about something that is very different from when we're talking about white beauty pageants. Like they're different. And so kind of exploring the different ways Black women and their relationship to beauty and their kind of quote unquote permission or allowance to be beautiful in a white supremacist society is a really different beast that we cannot collapse. Cause right, this is like typical white feminism. When we collapse an understanding of something, it usually only benefits white women and only really understands the, you know, historical context of white women. And so that's another one that I think is a really interesting, if you're interested in beauty standards, like if you're interested in beauty and attraction, it's like, for me, was one of those books that really challenged what I thought about beauty.
That sounds so interesting too. Oh my gosh. These are great recommendations. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And so finally, to close, what is like one thing that the audience can do to support you and support your work?
I would say for me right now, and I know that we've talked about this in consulting, the most important thing to me right now is Instagram follows, because Instagram is really ruining my life and keeps me on. It is keeping me on the precipice. It goes back and forth between 19.1 and 19.2K every day. It just switches back and forth, and it is driving me, like, it is so difficult for me to be playing this game, and I know it shouldn't matter, and this is just my vanity. I feel like that would be the most useful thing is to get Instagram to stop being annoying and just get me to be solidly at 19.2 or more. You know, both, like, I'm really struggling with the fact that it keeps falling down to 19.1.
Honestly, like, let's dream
big.
That
would really support my mental health. Like, if I'm being honest with you, that would be supportive.
Honestly, let's get her to 19.3, listeners. Let's everyone share.
Let's do it.
Share Melissa to 5 of your friends, and we'll get rid of 19.1 forever. It'll be in the rearview mirror.
Yes, I would love that. I feel like it's like a number that's just going to haunt me for the rest of my life. So,
oh my gosh.
That sounds perfect.
That's so funny. Well, I could talk to you for hours, and I really appreciate you being generous with your time and all of the knowledge that you have. And I really am going to miss working with you on a regular basis.
I know, me too, but we're on the internet. We'll see each other. It'll be glorious.
Yeah, it'll be great. But yeah, really appreciate you.
Of course. Thank you so much.